Hello, everyone, and welcome back to an IMDb certified podcast. This is Reservations. I'm Jeremy Blair.
And I'm Rain Whalen. Oh, my God. We still need to find who did that.
No clue. By the way, we have an IMDb page. Go check it out.
Yes. Whoever did it, thank you. And also, sorry that we kind of took control and updated it. Not sorry because we kind of did the heavy lifting for you. Yeah. But also thank you. Like, because then that kind of led us down a rabbit hole. And now we have all of our other projects that we've done on IMDb.
Yep.
Did you see it corrected your name?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I didn't think they were going to. I'm going to be honest. Because
they haven't added my picture yet. So
it asked me for a reason. Like, why the name change? And I was like, it's his birth name. Like, what do you want me to say?
Because he asked me to.
Because he asked me to.
I know him.
And I don't have anything better to do. You know, but then Ashley brought up a good point. Hmm. You know, since as we've learned, anyone could put anything on IMDb.
Yes.
So how do studios prevent people from fucking with their shit?
I don't know. You know. That's a good question. I think, you know, people who frequent IMDb like we do appreciate the correct information that they've compiled, right? And so I think it's just like or it could be just like it's regulated. So like someone is always looking, you know, for things, but of course that would be, it would be many somebody's because it's like a vast database.
I just had this thought. I think it's because once the studio uploads everything, they verify it. Cause I remember seeing this cause I was trying to get your picture added and I saw this thing that said cast/crew verification. Mm-hmm. And I guess once you verify it, you cannot make any more changes. And I was like, ooh, well, we're still updating it.
But by the way, those of you who are listening, Zach, who is probably the person that put this slander in there in the first place, but it doesn't matter. feel free to put in any trivia you want. There is already a scathing, untrue trivia in there right now.
Let's hope future Rain has that just slowly go across the screen.
it's funny. So I don't know who added it, but good job. Keep it up. Make up some lore. You know, we don't have any lore.
I literally, as soon as you said that, when you texted that, I literally out loud at work went, got him. And then everyone looked at me like,
technically the trivia is half true because I do hate James Cameron, so that part is true. Thinking anything positive about the movie is not true. So
you know what? Jesus.
Now Rain.
Yes.
We won't get into details because then we really would be scabs, but we did see Barbenheimer over the weekend.
Well, I learned that people, entertainment journalists, people who analyze film, we're not scabbing. We're allowed to do this.
Great. I can't believe you just called us journalists. That is, that's not what we are, but I appreciate it.
Well, that's why I quickly pivoted to people who analyze film.
Sure.
And plus, we're not being paid by the studios.
That's true.
Fuck those guys.
Yeah, fuck studios. Hopefully the writers and the actors can get what they need to survive, and hopefully the studios will all crumble. So that being said,
well, hang on. Before we get into Barbenheimer, my buddy Quentin went to California for a family trip and they did a studio tour of Warner Brothers, and he was texting me about it. And I was like, wait, they're doing studio tours right now?
That's bizarre.
And he was like, yeah, I think technically what we did was breaking the line. I was like, well, then that means you're a scab.
They crossed the line, yeah.
But I guarantee it's probably because Warner Brothers is trying to be like, no, everything's fine.
Everything's
like,
fine.
Come in. Come come see where dreams are made.
But you know what I didn't think about because of the strike is those actors who do podcasts.
Uh-huh.
It's gone. Like my Sunny in Philadelphia podcast I like, gone, because they're not going to do new episodes because they're not working.
Which is interesting, never mind. I answered my own question. You kind of answered my question for me, because I said it's interesting because I listened to the Pod Meets World podcast, mm-hmm. but they've still been uploading episodes. I mean, they went and picketed, mm-hmm. but then they've been like uploading new episodes. But I guess
it's been 2 weeks, so I don't know.
Well, and also before we actually get into Barbenheimer. Mom just got back from Comic-Con and she was telling me how, virtually no actors were there unless they were there promoting the things that they actually owned. Like, I didn't know this, but John Heder and TJ Miller own an animation company. So they were there promoting that because they own it. But like, actors couldn't be there. They couldn't talk about past projects. They couldn't talk about future projects. So it's like, what's even the point to go?
I know, why are you
And then as I learned, they had, I guess they brought in YouTubers as moderators for certain panels. Because like one YouTuber, like Nakey Jakey, moderated the Talk to Me panel with the directors. So.
Weird.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yeah. So hopefully, again, like you said, the actors and the writers get paid what they deserve and we can start getting better content out of the studios for it.
So.
So Barbenheimer, buddy.
Yeah.
So.
Oppenheimer. It was amazing.
It was literally everything I wanted. It's like. And it did not disappoint. And I love that we just go. Christopher did not waste any time. Didn't waste any time with setup. He just like, no, we're going.
Yeah.
And we're not stopping for 3 hours. And I was sold. Sold, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. It was incredible. And he said that obviously the explosion is not CG, right?
Right.
We knew that. But he said there's no CG. Which means the other stuff, we won't get into it because that's, spoilers, but there are some stuff in there that you think might be CG and he is claiming they are not. Which I can see how it's possible for it not to be. I mean, it's not impossible. It's just a lot of work.
Yeah, well, and, as we've learned, Christopher Nolan, he puts in that work.
Yeah.
He puts in that time.
Now, unfortunately, I was not able to see it in 70 millimeter, but it is possible to see it in 70 millimeter. And it's sold out for like months.
Yeah. I was going to ask if you guys were able to, because obviously we did not, as Midland had a theater shutdown, even though their IMAX theater wasn't 70 millimeter IMAX, it was just standard IMAX. So we had to see it at Synergy, but that's on a Dolby Atmos mm-hmm. screen, which it still looked amazing, but I do wish we could have seen it in the 70 millimeter.
It would have been really cool. The film stock weighs 600 pounds and it's 11 miles long, I think is what he said.
You could bench press that.
Sure. 600? Easy. On each side?
No problem.
And of course, if you could tilt your camera down a little bit.
Yes.
Barbie was also awesome.
Oh, yeah, dude. It also was everything I wanted it to be and more. Like, the humor was great. The message was great. And of course, the big thing is the cast worked so well together.
Yes. I think the highlight, I think most people would say it would be Margot Robbie, but it's obviously Ryan Gosling is the highlight.
Dude, he stole every scene he was in. But I also just love all the different Kens, but they're, you know, because that joke I really like, that they're all Barbie and they're all Ken.
Yeah.
Even though except they look Alan. Different. Yeah. Oh my God. In every scene, I thought for sure Michael Cera was just going to show up for like two scenes, but he's like throughout the whole movie. And I was like, dude, give me more Alan.
I think most people would like Barbie. Go see it. I think most people would like it. I think it's great.
And I just want to say this.
I just want to say most people are going to love Barbie. Okay. It's fun. It's light. It's bright. It's fun. It's funny. I think some people might have a hard time with Oppenheimer just because of the length of the movie itself. So be cautious, but trust me, those 3 hours are going to fly by. It was amazing. So
And I just wanted to add to the caution as well, but this is for Barbie, and I'm going to try to make it less political.
Let's find out.
Please go in with an open mind. I mean, I know there's already all these. What are you doing?
I'm paying attention.
Yeah, I know. I already know there's all these posts of people saying the movie's too political, and I'm like, just go in with an open mind, and you'll love it. Like, I didn't hear a single negative thing when we saw it last night. Mm-hmm. So just all I ask, even though no one's listening, just go in with an open mind. That's it.
Yeah.
And you'll love the movie. And the movie is fun, and the soundtrack slaps. I listened to the soundtrack all day today. It slaps. So Greta Gerwig, thank you.
Yeah.
So buddy, what are we talking about today? Your final pick of the season.
That's right. This week we are discussing Fritz Lang's 1953 film noir, The Big Heat.
So, as you said last week, this was a first time for you. Yes. So, what did you think? Did it pay off?
Okay. So, here's how I normally do things. Okay.
Okay.
I normally I find time to watch it on a Thursday or a Friday. I saw this movie 2 hours ago.
Pulled a Rain.
I did. I normally don't do that. We were so busy this weekend that I literally had no time to watch it. We were just going and going and going all weekend long. Those of you who follow me on Instagram, you may have saw that I was tagged in. One of Haley's best friends came into town and we went rock climbing. So that was one of the things we did. So we were super busy. Crushed it, by the way. Thank you for asking. I watched it 3 hours ago. Or 2 hours ago. So what did I think?
Yes.
I really liked it.
Okay.
I really liked it. I thought the story was compelling. It kept me intrigued. There was, you know, you're constantly trying to figure out, like, is there actually something going on? Is he crazy? And then, of course, shit goes down and you're like, okay, obviously something's going down. But now he has to figure it out, right? And then remembering what happened before and trying to tie that back to the information you now have, you know, it was great. Unexpected in the way everything unfolded and who got to do what was really interesting, and who really saved the day is sort of interesting, because it definitely wasn't our Sergeant Dave who really saved the day. So it was really interesting and I liked it. It's a good ending, I think, for this Fritz Langathon that we've been doing. So.
Yeah, I agree. I was a little worried because, again, you know, we had some duds with Fritz. So I was like, fuck, I don't want this last one to be a dud.
Yeah.
But I really enjoyed it. And like I was sold the minute it started, like, which we'll get into, but like opening with that, I was like, all right, let's go, man. I'm in.
I know.
But yeah, I really enjoyed it. I really liked, I especially liked how things escalated so quickly. Mm-hmm. And it really became a game of cat and mouse and, you know, who's on the payroll, who's not, who can I trust? And it, I really enjoyed it too.
Definitely.
And also I was worried that it wasn't going to work on my PlayStation 5, but it was because, you know, since it's a region, it's region B, right? The indicator.
No, mine is all region. So I don't know if yours is or not, but
I think
mine's got the three letters on it. So
hang on, let's see.
Oh my God. But, compelling to listen to.
No, I think, see, it has that. Oh, no, no, that's A, B, and C.
Yeah,
that's on the back.
Yeah, it's region B. Yeah. But it is an import, so I understand why you were worried.
I loved it, man. So, would you like me to hit everyone with that synopsis? Then we can get into it.
Let's do it one more time.
All right. Okay. The Big Heat, 1953. I didn't mean to say stars, but I already said it, so we're going to go with it. Stars Glenn Ford as Sergeant. I have their names up because I watched this last night. Sergeant Dave Banyan. He is a homicide detective trying to solve the supposed suicide of a fellow cop. And everything is pointing towards suicide until he meets the cop's mistress and something just doesn't sit right with him. And then the mistress ends up dead. And so he starts to slowly uncover this web of conspiracy of a crime organization that's essentially running the city. And in classic detective mystery format, he's threatened, told to drop the case, just leave it alone. But Dave is not only a good cop, but he's a good person. So, of course, he's not going to let it go. And winds up getting his wife killed, which was fucking insane.
Yeah.
And I desperately want to talk about that, which only sends him down the rabbit hole more to now a quest for revenge, because who killed my wife? And he gets help from the most unlikeliest ally. Until it all culminates in, I guess you would assume, or if you would correct me if I'm wrong, a classic noir shootout where Dave kind of helps put the syndicate to bed, and that's the Big Heat.
That's really.
It's because, again, I didn't want to waste time on the small things because I really wanted to talk about that.
Yeah.
But so where would you like to begin, buddy?
So, I mean, man, Fritz Lang really knows how to pull you in because it starts off with a suicide, right?
Yeah.
A dude blows his brains out. And when his wife finds him, she finds this letter that's not addressed to her. And it's clearly addressed to, I think, like the district attorney or something, right?
Yes. Yeah.
And so she's reading it. And then when the cops get there and when Sergeant Banning gets there, he tells one of the guys, so there's no note or anything? And the guy's like, no, nothing. And you're like, yes, there was. And so now we're just like, right. Because now something is already amiss, right? So
why wouldn't she give them this note?
Right. So she's obviously in on it. Now, what I liked what Fritz is doing in this film is, and at first I was sort of weird, right? I'll explain in a second. But it was sort of weird every time we would go to this place and it would feel kind of out of place. But I think I know why it's like this. So when Sergeant Banyan goes home to his wife and his daughter, it seems weird. Like, it seems out of place because it's very like 1950s, like father knows best type, mm-hmm. like family, like television. Like, that's what it feels like. Right. Like 50s family television. And so it's out of place because everything is sweet and nice and happy and quirky and, you know, sort of fun. And of course it has to be that way because we need that emotion when it's taken away. Right.
Right.
And so at first I was sort of like taken aback by these scenes of the Banyans, because mm-hmm. it just didn't fit with the overall noir. Right.
Right.
And again, it being this film noir, I immediately was like, he's going to screw it up somehow. He's going to like find some bimbo. Right. And then mess all this up. Right. Because that's usually how these things go. Yeah. And I'm really glad it never did. Like, either way, he's faithful to his wife the whole way. And I like that.
Yeah. And not only faithful, you know, I love it. He snaps at her and then he immediately is like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, yeah. I didn't mean that. You're right. It's because Fritz really wants us to understand that he's a family man first, yeah. a policeman second.
Like, home is safe. Home is a safe place. It's a nice place to be. And then, mm-hmm. of course, until it isn't. And then, you know, then yeah. he's got to leave. I ended up really liking those scenes in retrospect. Like, it really helps with the emotion of the film. Sergeant Banyan is like your stereotypical, how people say it in the movies, he's a Boy Scout, right? He's mm-hmm. loyal to his job, loyal to his family. He doesn't take kindly to corruption or conspiracy, and so like he would never be sucked in anything like that, which is why he didn't know about it in the first place. And what was interesting is when his trail led him to the crime boss, mm-hmm. he knows all about him, right? Like, he's like, this isn't the first time they've met, this isn't the first time they've dealt with one another, this isn't, you know, the first time he's realizing he's a crime boss. Like, this is just who he is. He was a bootlegger in the 1920s during Prohibition. So like, he knows this mm-hmm. guy, which I found fascinating because this is a time period where people his age and organized crime would have lived through that as a criminal if that's what they chose to do. Right.
Right.
Which is, I thought was really cool because being put in just 1953, you know, the 1920s weren't that far. So I thought that was cool. Anyway, so I liked that, he's not discovering, oh my God, there's crime in the city. Of course there is, right? And he knows exactly who's doing it. But I don't think he realizes just how deep it goes or how far the web spreads. Right.
Right. Yeah, I would agree. Cause you know, sorry. Because he only goes to, I know his first name's Mike. Mike Lagana. He only goes to his house after he gets the threatening telephone call at home that you need to drop this. And so, you know, I would agree that he just assumes like, okay, so maybe I'm just encroaching on Mike's latest hustle or something like that. And yeah, he doesn't realize how deep the conspiracy really goes until the catalyst of.
Yeah. I think once he's, well, yeah.
Yeah.
So quick story. I'm watching the movie. I'm about at that part. Right. So I'm about 40 minutes in, maybe.
Yeah.
And Haley comes home. She brings food. Thank God, I was starving. It was Taco Bell, by the way. And
nice. Did you get a Crunchwrap?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wait, no. I got a Cheesy Gordita Crunch. It doesn't matter.
Oh, but, even better.
Yeah. But anyway, so we're eating, and again, she has not been watching this movie. She's not even paying attention.
Uh-huh.
She looks up, and it's the scene where they're at home, and the wife, Mrs. Banion's about to leave, and he's tossing her his keys or whatever, and they have that nice little fun, stupid moment. And Haley goes, "She's gonna die." And I go, "You don't know that." And also, maybe, I don't know. And then the car blows up. And of course, it's setting it up perfectly. And I know I saw it coming that, you know, he's obviously not driving, and we're making a big deal about it, that he's tossing her his keys and she's going to get in the car. And I love that we hear the door close and the car start, right? Mm-hmm. The audio language of that is really cool. And I like that, you know, we stay with Dave Banion with his daughter, and we're giving her enough time to exit the house and go to the car and turn it on while being distracted by him having this nice, sweet moment with his daughter. And then the car explodes.
Well, you know, I thought for sure that she was going to survive, because he pulls her out of the car. And of course, I know it's 1953, you know, they're not going to show her on fire.
Right.
But I thought for sure, I was like, she's not on fire, she's fine. And then the very next scene, like, you know, well, something about the funeral, and I was like, oh shit, she died. I was like, damn.
Yeah.
Fritz Lang's not holding back.
No. So that was wild. Right. So once his wife dies, and he's talking to the police commissioner, and the police commissioner is being super shady. I think that's where he's like, all right,
do they fire him or suspend him?
Well, they suspend him because they weren't going to, but then he keeps pushing, and then he makes insinuations that they're working for
Lagana,
that they're working for Lagana, right? And that, you know, he keeps making insinuations that they're in his pocket. And of course, they're offended by that, but also knowing that it's true, and then they suspend him, and then he quits. So here's where things get interesting in terms of what this movie could have been, right? Okay. So the character of Debbie Marsh, who is the girlfriend or wife? I wasn't quite sure.
I think she's just girlfriend.
Okay, Vince Stone, right?
Long time casual girlfriend.
Okay. And so she's dating Vince Stone. Vince Stone is the right-hand man of Lagana, right?
Mm-hmm.
And she's sort of, you know, this tough, silly, kind of dumb, but assertive woman who becomes very integral to the plot, right?
Mm-hmm.
Originally, they wanted Marilyn Monroe.
Oh.
But the studio that she was working for at the time, and I think it was either Warner Brothers.
I thought she was contracted with MGM.
It may have been MGM. I don't really remember. But the studio said, you can have her, but for you to use her, it costs this much. And they're like, no. Like, that's insane.
No, thank you.
Yeah, like, that's insane. We'll get someone else. Thank you. But think about what this movie could have been. It wouldn't have been her first film noir. That would have been, I think, The Asphalt Jungle. But it would have been really interesting, because I think that would have – I don't know. I may have rooted for her more if it had been Marilyn Monroe. But that's my personal opinion.
Well, no, I know. I see what you're saying, because Debbie, would you say in terms of – classic noir tropes, would you say Debbie is our femme fatale?
I think so, because she is a dangerous woman, but not necessarily for our protagonist, not for Banion, but for herself and other people around her, right? So she's not making things necessarily worse for Banion. She is sort of trying to seduce Banion a little bit, which is weird, and Banion is having none of that.
cuts that shit off now.
But which I respected, but which would have made, I think would have made the story very boring if they had become entangled in
romantically entangled. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I like that she sort of he sort of becomes her confidant, you know, that he takes care of her after Vince, which we'll get into. Hopefully, you know, Vince fucking scalds her with coffee.
Yes. So fun fact, if you Google the Big Heat Twilight Time is a now defunct physical media releaser. That's not the right word.
Distributor. Anyway,
thank you. And they would release films that, you know, I have a couple of them. They're extremely hard to find. They're very expensive. But the one for the Big Heat was a coffee pot. That was the cover of the,
that's cool,
of the Blu-ray, which was, I thought was really cool. But yeah, so what's fascinating about Debbie is that she really is the one who defuncts the crime syndicate. She's the one that unravels them, which is mind blowing, because this entire time you think that she's, you know, she's just a side character. She's current motivation for Banyan to get this done because Vince is going to kill her eventually, right?
Mm-hmm.
If he doesn't stop any of this, she's going to keep getting hurt, and that's no good because he wants to protect everybody. He's a Boy Scout. We've established that already, right? She's not a bad person. She's just entangled with bad people, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But then when she fucking kills that woman, what is her name?
Duncan.
Yeah.
Bertha Duncan.
When she kills Bertha Duncan, I thought, okay, well, if she killed Bertha Duncan, then I immediately thought, okay, then it's not going to work. Then her dying isn't going to do anything, right? I only thought that because that's not how the story is supposed to go. The story is supposed to go, either Banyan is supposed to kill her or have her arrested and make her
tell him
where the documents are, where the letter is. And when she does it, when she kills Bertha, I was like, then now what? Now what else? Because that was your only thing, you know?
Well,
it worked.
Yeah. Well, and I thought for sure, a part of me wasn't fully sold that Debbie had turned over a leaf.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, okay. Fuck. She just killed Bertha.
Yeah.
With Dave's gun, because he left it to her. So I was like, fuck, like she's going to get him framed.
Yeah.
And this is how they're going to get to him. But no. And I actually appreciated the fact that this pretty much helps Dave,
mm-hmm.
not only in the investigation, but in his kind of quest for justice for his wife.
Yes. It didn't go. So the movie didn't veer too far in sort of like our theme of last week, which is vengeance overtaking you, right? And becoming, you know, this unstoppable evil force within you. And it taints everything and everyone around you, right? That was sort of last week.
Right.
This time I was like, it's kind of like that because he is going a little overboard with, especially with Bertha, he was going to choke her, you know?
Yeah.
Well. That was pretty wild. But he never gets too crazy. It never drives him nuts, right?
Even like we saw in
Scarlet Street, right? Like he never went nuts with his vengeance.
Yeah. He definitely just wants justice.
Mm-hmm.
If that means he's gonna have to get a little dirty, then that's what he's gonna have to do. But he's not going to, you know, not Sweeney Todd level. He's not gonna let it. And I think it's because, if we're going to do a comparison to last week,
sure.
I think it's because Dave has his daughter.
Yeah.
And so he has someone
who
needs him. as where Sweeney lost his daughter. So as you brought up last week, you know, he probably had the mindset of it's better if she doesn't know me.
Yeah.
So his vengeance could consume him. As for Dave, I think he knew, like, I can't let this consume me. I'm going to get an answer, but I can't let it eat away at me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or who knows? Maybe we're both just reaching and, you know, Fritz Lang is laughing at us and being like, you dumb idiots. That's not what it's about at all.
But yeah, you know, yeah, because even at the end where he had the perfect opportunity to kill Vince, he didn't do it.
Nope. Right. He gave him to the cops and said, you know, take him in. This is all you'll need.
Yeah. At the cost of Debbie, of course. Debbie died.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, dude. And so if we're going to talk about that real quick, I thought for sure she was going to make it out. Like after I realized what she was doing, of course, the movie kind of spells it out for us why she's doing this. I was like, okay, great. She's on Team Dave. She's trying to help Dave. But I was like, why is she just walking away? She got what she wanted out of Vince. Why isn't she leaving?
Yeah.
Cause then she just walks where he could easily shoot her. Mm-hmm. But you know, now saying this out loud, I'm wondering if maybe that was her plan. Maybe she knew she wasn't going to make it out alive.
Maybe, or maybe she just, you know, the heat of the moment. Anyway,
that's the name of the movie.
No heat, because she got him with scalding hot coffee. It doesn't matter. All right. I don't need to explain my puns to you. But anyway, so maybe like in that moment, she threw the coffee in his face. Right. Which means she would have had to show up like super early and make the coffee. But she threw the coffee in his face, and then she was like, I did it finally, like, fuck you, I got him back, whatever. And then she was like, she didn't even think about, oh wait, he's got a gun on him all the time. Yeah. Or you're right, maybe she was just like, whatever, I'm not getting out of here alive. I scalded him with hot coffee, let's go. You know.
Well, see, because it makes me wonder if that was her plan, like, I know I'm not gonna make it out alive, at least they can get him on a murder charge, and because they'll have proof. But then again, that kind of my theory gets shot down because she asks Dave, am I gonna die? Mm-hmm. You know, so I think yours is more right. I think she was just, I think she was riding that I got you back high. Yeah. And didn't think like, oh wait, he's got a gun, I should probably get out of here. But I mean, at least Dave kind of showed up. Not really to rescue her, but to, you know, close the lid on that kibosh that way. Yeah. And I thought for sure he was going to kill Vince, like 100%.
Yeah, of course.
I was like, he's going to do it. He's going to kill Vince. But no, I think with kind of what you've been saying, I think the movie is better that he didn't.
Yes,
that I agree. That Dave took the hard way, said, no, you're going in alive. You're getting arrested. We've got evidence against you. There we go.
Yeah. And that, you know, he kept his. He kept his values, right? He kept what he. What he considers to be right, he kept those intact instead of going against his better judgment and, you know, letting his vengeance take over, you know, who he is, right? Which is a good person.
Right.
There's something else I was going to say about that. I don't remember what it was. Damn. I wasn't expecting the prosthetic burn on her face.
Neither was I.
Yeah.
I thought for sure we would just see Debbie with the bandage on the whole movie. Yep. And that looked really good, man. Really, really good.
It wasn't bad.
I thought for sure they I was like, man, they must have actually burned her with real coffee because it looked good.
It didn't look bad.
And maybe because since it was black and white is why it looked even better. I feel like if it was in color, maybe
there's no way.
You're going to be like, oh, yeah, there's the. But I liked that they actually had it all on her face and a little bit on her neck.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was not expecting that either.
So something that I wish I had looked into more that I didn't. Is that this movie is based on Saturday Evening Post serial stories, meaning
yes,
stories that are serialized over a number of weeks in the Saturday Evening Post.
Yes, yeah, I saw that, and I also meant to look it up, but after I finished the movie, I continued doing laundry and playing Assassin's Creed.
Well, which may also be why the story is so good and so dense, because it's from long form storytelling. So
right.
It's from unraveling a story one week at a time. And so you're getting this beat by beat film where you're starting to piece things together after you've been given some information that in retrospect you're like, oh, that makes sense, because that's why she took the letter, and that's why they don't know there's a note, and that's why he killed himself, because he was too far into the pocket of this guy, right? And he wanted it to all unravel, and the only way he knew how to do that was write this letter, kill himself to make a scene, and that people would pay attention to it, right?
Yeah, yeah, real Stanley Uris, right there.
Nice.
Okay, good. I was like, wait, what if what was that too deep cut of a reference?
It wasn't. It was good.
Well, specifically chapter 2, because they made his suicide more of a heroic sacrifice than the actual just coward's way out.
Besides, this is a complete tangent, but besides the sewer and Adrian Mellon, that's how the book starts, is with Stanley Uris' death. So
really,
you don't have to get that far in the book to get to that. Yeah.
You know, I started reading the book.
Well, you didn't get that.
I got two pages in and I was like, oh, fuck. We're talking about it, everyone.
Spit that out my nose.
But anyway, I agree. I think, well, obviously, I can't say I think. Obviously, that was... I don't remember his first name. I just know his last name is Duncan. That was obviously his plan. It's because, his mistress. I'm not going to look it up. His mistress was telling Banyan that, something was off with him. Something was wrong. But then Banyan's like, but his wife is telling me that he was in good health. Like, why would he? I'm getting conflicting stories here. And I think that's what really sets him off. Like, okay, something's up. Like, you're telling me one thing, but she's telling me another, and she's telling all the police this.
And then, of course, she dies the next day, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because they caught up to her. Lagana and his men. Well, just the Larry. Was the name Larry?
Yeah, his name was Larry. And all I could think of the whole time. And I'm going to try and make this not sound awful.
Let's see.
But I did laugh when Lagana was criticizing how he's been killing people.
Yeah.
Like, you just dumped that girl. You got us all this unwanted attention.
Mm-hmm.
And then you kill his wife. And he's like, well, how was I supposed to know she was going to drive the car?
Yeah.
Which, I mean, credit to Larry. Yeah. Like, how did he know that she was going to drive the car?
Yeah.
But I kind of chuckled to myself. I was like, man, he's criticizing how he's killing people.
Well, to Lagana's credit, I mean, it was sloppy. So,
But then, if you watch a Martin Scorsese movie, Goodfellas, they're just leaving bodies everywhere.
Sure. You're right. you bring up a decent topic, which is the dialogue, because I loved the dialogue in this. It was it was so quintessential 1950s that I really, really liked it, right?
I'm a little, just a little, disappointed that no one said the word gumshoe. Even though I know that's not a 1950s term, I think that's like 1930s. But I was picking up on a lot of the 1950s slang, and I was like, someone's got to say gumshoe.
Oh my
please. God. And no one said it.
So sorry.
I know. Let me call it Fritz Lang's grandkids.
Yeah, his estate. And just
like recut this film and someone dub over somewhere and say gumshoe.
Ridiculous. That's so
nah. No, but no, I agree. I really love the dialogue. It reminded me a lot of Fury.
Yeah.
In terms of how fast paced the dialogue was and how quick and how witty everyone was. Mm-hmm. They were just back and forth, back and forth. Yeah, I loved it.
Yeah, you know, I love how, you know, it is very fast, very fast paced. I like the cadence of everyone's speaking voice. And I don't know, like it seems like a silly thing to talk about, but I like it. It that stuff sort of matters in how you see the movie and how you absorb the information, of course. And it was easy to follow. I was like, I'm like, am I going to get lost? Like, it's a pretty dense story with all this stuff going on. And I hope I don't lose some information somewhere because something isn't like spelled out for me too much. Or if something is maybe laid out in a way with jargon, with slang, with language from that time that I'm not familiar with, and then I'm going to lose it. Right. Because a lot of this is they talk in sort of metaphor. Or they sort of beat around the bush with what they're talking about, but you still get it because of the context, right? And so that's always a concern for me watching these films, is I want to understand everything and I want to enjoy it, right? But I also don't want to be lost with context I don't have because of when I live, you know?
No, I get that. Yeah. Yeah. Because I know that there's you know, movies out there, a perfect example, Odd Man Out, you know, that is so not only of the times, but of the region that you and I were both like,
yeah,
why does this matter?
Right. And you know, the language they use, the jargon they use and the context they use is, you're like, I don't know, you know, I don't know any of this.
Yeah.
I guess I had to be there, you know.
I had to be in Ireland in the what, 30s?
40s, I think.
47.
And so that's always a concern for me, but this one, it was perfect. It was awesome. So I still got some of that cool 50s jargon and context, but without losing the story. The story was still crystal clear.
Now, I do have some other small disappointments. Again, nothing that takes away from the movie, that I really enjoyed it. But your theory, I don't remember if it was last week or when we did Scarlet Street. There weren't a lot of Fritz Lang-isms in this movie. It was just a straight crime noir.
Yeah.
I would say the only Fritz Lang-isms were the violence, really, you know, the opening with a suicide and the fucking car bomb.
Yeah.
But I was like, are we going to get some like overlays? Are we going to get some cool, like something? And I think you're right. This is his full blown drive right into noir.
But what's really interesting is we can start. I think we've covered everything. We can start doing what I wanted to do at the end of this episode.
Okay.
Which is sort of a retrospective. Where do we start? Where are we now? What, you know, how has this filmmaker evolved over time? Which is kind of what I wanted to do with this series anyway, which is sort of, you know, see where he started, where we're sort of finishing in his career. I think he had 6 movies after this, which seems like a lot, but it's in with his filmography, it's not.
Because his last one was a Dr. Mabuse film, right? And then he was done.
I don't really remember what his last one was, but okay, I want you guys to remember, those of you listening at home, you watched this movie, okay? Hopefully. I want you guys to remember, this guy made Metropolis, okay?
Yeah, shout out to season 2, I think is when we did Metropolis.
This guy made Destiny. You know, this guy, you know, he made Dr. Mabuse. This guy made M, you know? Like, to me, it's just such a different... I think, you know, when... I don't know if he was his best during the silent era. I think that's a good argument. I wouldn't be upset if someone said his best work was when he was doing silent films. Because what Fritz Lang excelled at was not only his visual style, but also his inventiveness, his creativity, his way of pushing the medium to a new edge, right? So like, here's the edge of where cinema is. Here's what you can do with the camera. And he just pushed the ledge a little bit further. He goes, no, it's not. It's over here. Right.
Right.
I can actually do a lot more than you think. Right.
I'm not saying I disagree. Mm-hmm. I agree. I'm going to add to that. I would say the silent film era is where he got to experiment a lot. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he didn't have to worry about sound until we get, I mean, I know not specifically with M, but when he started doing talkies, then he was like, okay, now I've already experimented with the camera. I know what we can do with the camera. Let's experiment with sound. Mm-hmm. What can we do with sound? And now, yes, we did have some duds with Ministry of Fear. And what was the other one? Spies?
Yeah, you and I didn't think Spies was his best, but of course that was a silent film. But but I mean, we didn't like it as much. Zach liked it better than Dr. Mabuse. So, I mean, you know, like there's obviously, you know, that's not like a definitive, like, opinion, but yeah, you know, I think his best is M. That's just my personal opinion. I think it goes M and then Metropolis and whatever. We can do that forever. But I think the further he gets into his sound era and his noir eras, I don't know. It seems to me like he really narrowed in on this film noir thing, which works in his favor. I think that his way of telling stories, the types of stories he wants to tell and the way he wants to tell them lends perfectly to film noir, like we discussed many years ago in our film noir episode.
That's for sure a season one episode.
It started with German Expressionism. And so he comes from that background. And so, of course, noir is a perfect transition to that. Did he bring all of his creativity and gusto to a lot of these later sound films? I don't think so. Not necessarily a bad thing. It may have been even distracting.
This is something, you know, that's something I asked you last week is, do you think it was him having to deal with, you know, American filmmaking versus, I guess you'd say, the freedom he had when he was filming his films in Germany?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I mean, yes, we have had discussions of him fighting with studios over small details that, I mean, we say small, but they matter, right? In terms of, you know, like ending, I'm still so mad about it. Ending Ministry of Fear with a joke, that's got to be a studio decision. right?
What? Cake? Yeah.
It's got to be, right? Like that's not Fritz Lang. Fritz Lang doesn't do that. Fritz Lang throws an actor down the stairs 17 times until he gets the perfect shot and he doesn't apologize. That's Fritz Lang, you know?
Yeah.
He makes these films that are powerful, in your face, and tell a dark story. That's Fritz Lang.
Mm-hmm.
So to have to deal with the American studio system, I think does change the way he makes films, in not necessarily in a terrible way. I really like Scarlet Street. I really like The Big Heat. I really liked Fury. Like these are good examples of his American films. I heard Cloak and Dagger wasn't very good. I've read reviews on that. I think that's with Gary Cooper. So there's and of course we hated Ministry of Fear. I will go ahead and say I hated it, even though the seance was amazing. That scene was incredible, but
it was the most Fritz Lang of the entire film.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But again, I think maybe once we get this far and once he's starting to tell these film noir stories, straight noir, I think putting these, what we refer to as Fritz Langisms, these overlay shots, these sort of movie magic shots, high production, high visual value shots don't make sense in The Big Heat. Right. There's no place for it. There was a place for it in Fury, with him looking in that window and seeing the reflections of all those people. That works, right?
Mm-hmm.
It kind of works for Scarlet Street with the hyper stylized courtroom stuff, in the witness stands. That works. Big Heat, maybe not so much.
Well, and you know, kind of like what you've been saying with the type of stories that Fritz Lang was wanting to tell, you know, though I feel like those two specifically, Scarlet Street and Fury, had a lot of theatrics in it, you know, of characters, you know, lying or getting revenge. But as were The Big Heat is more of a grounded story. So I think he recognized like, well, I can't have a theatrical direct camera monologue from any actor. Like we have to keep it contained, which I think is another reason why you and I liked it so much, that it was in and of itself, it had Fritz Lang isms, even though if there weren't any that directly stood out.
Mm-hmm. And you know, this was a bunch of fun. So getting to see, and it's so fascinating, getting to see a filmmaker's journey, right, throughout his filmography, was so much fun. It's fascinating to see the way that their style evolves and changes and ebbs and flows, and what they keep over time, what they lose over time, if something changes, what was it that changed it, right? Because where they are in terms of their career, their life, all that matters too, right? If Fritz Lang had never met his wife in Germany, forget it. Who knows what we would have had, right? We wouldn't have gotten these amazing silent films. Probably,
yeah, definitely.
Right? Even though she was horrible and a Nazi, but whatever.
Oh my God, was she really?
She ended up being.
Shit.
Yeah, we talked about that.
Thank God he was like, nope, I'm going to America.
I mean, she cheated on him a lot, but he cheated on her a lot. So, I mean, it's whatever.
Well, then the icing on the cake is at least he wasn't a Nazi.
That's right. Title of the episode.
At least he wasn't a Nazi. At least
he wasn't a Nazi. But it makes me wonder, like, I do recommend people do this because it's fun to sit and just watch a director's filmography in a row. Not necessarily all of it, because that would take forever, especially with Fritz Lang. He has so many silent films that we didn't even talk about, right? That are completely different from the ones we did talk about. He's got some fantasy epics and action adventures in there that have nothing to do with crime, right? That are fascinating. But like, let's take like Scorsese. We could have done, you know, Scorsese and do those, right?
But I feel like we've done that. You know, we've done his crime films, sort of. But we've also done, you know, Raging Bull is technically a sports movie.
That's true.
You know, and you know, and then we've got Silence, which is a spiritual film. You know.
Yeah, you're right.
We could have.
And I can't wait for Killers of the Flower Moon.
Oh my god, it's gonna be so good.
It's gonna be great. But it'd be cool. You know, like, and with Tim Burton, we'll talk about it next week. But his change and what he's evolved into, right? Is interesting. So it's just cool. This was a good idea. I don't know who had this idea, but it was a good idea.
I think it actually was my wife, Ash. Ashley was like, y'all should pick one director each and just do that. And then I think we took that idea and we're like, okay, we'll go in chronological order of their filmography.
I think that was a good idea, to go in chronological order and not jump around.
I think my original idea was I was going to jump around. I was going to start with not necessarily my least favorite, but the one I watched the least, and then go. But then I think when you sent me your list and your list was in chronological order, I was like, okay, no, we'll do it in chronological
order. And a part of me wanted to do it in chronological order for this reason, just to see the trajectory of their film career, right? And where their creativity and storytelling went, right, from A to Z.
Right.
So again, it blows my mind that the director of The Big Heat directed Metropolis. It's like you could end a career with Metropolis and be done and you'd be fine, right?
Yeah.
You could never have to work again, because that's like the greatest science fiction film ever made. One of the greatest films ever made. And then he does these home run film noirs that are less grand in scope, right? And they're still really good. I don't know. It blows my mind that it's the same person. Yeah. You know.
Well, you know, it's like I was trying to think of another good example, but there's so many good ones out there, you know. I mean, again, it's like, you know, Christopher Nolan, you know, he makes 3 Batman comic book movies and then turns around and makes Interstellar.
Yeah.
This, you know, epic sci-fi adventure. And then makes Dunkirk, a historical drama, you know.
I mean, you're right. I mean, Nolan's an interesting case.
Yeah.
Because he does have a
style. Definitely for sure. I mean, we've done Dunkirk, but that's definitely true. You know, definitely Tenet, Interstellar.
Don't count more Nolan out from us, because we'll definitely talk about more Nolan.
Yeah. Sure. But yeah, man. Well, I assumed we have wrapped up, which is a good segue into my final pick of the season. So to close out the Tim Burton side of this season, next week we are talking about the 2014. Is it a biodrama?
Yeah, it's a biopic.
We're just gonna say biopic. Big Eyes. This is one of Tim's movies that I've never seen. I have wanted to see, especially considering that it is highly, like, I think one of his highest rated films. And I think almost got an Oscar for it.
Oh, interesting.
Oh my God. Hang on. It was nominated for
a couple BAFTAs.
It won Golden Globe for Amy Adams, won for Best Actress. I don't see anything for the Academy Awards.
Interesting.
Okay. But yeah, so I mean, all I know is that it's based on a true story of this woman who paints a specific style of paintings, and her husband decides that he's going to help her and essentially takes all the credit for himself. And
huh, what movie does that sound like, right? Kind of sounds like Scarlet Street.
Oh. But reversed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, and Alex.
Yeah.
Jason Schwartzman is in. I haven't pulled up.
But yeah, I'm really excited. And of course, the cast sold me also. Amy Adams, Christoph Waltz. I was like, I'm sold. Like,
and Danny Houston. It's a
Tim Burton movie.
Fucking love Danny Houston. So.
But yeah, I'm interested to see the movie itself, but also to close out Tim's progression throughout this season as well. And then we're in the end of season series, which I'm super excited for.
Yeah, that's going to be a lot of fun. So you guys buckle up for that too, because that's going to be good. I promise.
Yeah. Well, I guess we will call it there. Everyone, we hope you enjoyed The Big Heat, and we will see you next week for Big Eyes.